From the studios of KPCW, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our impacts upon it. I'm Claire Wiley, and joining me again as our special guest host is Cheryl Fox, Executive Director of the Summit Land Conservancy. Welcome back, Cheryl.
Thank you. I'm happy to be part of the conversation today.
Well, we always love having you here, so thank you so much for sitting in that seat. We'll have Chris back here next week, but we love it when Cheryl joins us. And today, we're going to be starting our show talking with award-winning author and conservationist Zach Podmore. Podmore's latest book is titled After Deadpool, Lake Powell's Last Days and the Rebirth of the Colorado River. And we're going to be discussing his writing and his upcoming talk at the Park City Library happening at 6 p.m. in the Jim Santee Auditorium on March 24th. And then we'll be speaking with local conservation easement landowner Wes Sidaway. Now, Sidaway is going to share more about his family's decision around land preservation, something you know very well, Cheryl.
That's right. Well, the Sidaway family worked with Summit Land Conservancy and our partners to put about 73 acres of land along the Weber River in a conservation easement in 2013. And we're really excited to have Wes here today to talk about his family's decision to do that and the effects of living with conservation for the last 12 years.
Excellent. All that and more is coming up on This Green Earth. And now we are going to be welcoming to the podcast Zach Podmore, who is just penned a new book called After Deadpool, Lake Powell's Last Days and the Rebirth of the Colorado River. He is an award-winning author and conservationist. Zach, thank you so much for being a part of This Green Earth.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Well, Zach, generally we like to start here on This Green Earth with a little backstory on our guests. So why don't you tell us about yourself? As I understand it, am I correct in saying that you were born and raised in the West and it was at Colorado?
Yeah, I was born in Glenwood Springs, Colorado. Grew up not far from the Colorado River there. And that's kind of been the focus of the reporting ever since I moved to Utah in 2014, I've kept coming back to water as a topic that draws my journalism. So it kind of, you know, has its roots in a little creek in western Colorado that I grew up next to.
Yeah. So what is your relationship to rivers in the West that prompted you to be the author of articles and books?
Yeah, I grew up running rivers with my family, including a lot in Utah, multi-day float trips through Utah's canyon country on the Green and San Juan and Colorado rivers and others. And that was definitely my passion. You know, in high school and college, I was into doing kayak trips and rafting trips, and that influenced, you know, when I started to do journalism and started to write, that was definitely topics that, you know, drew my interest. And this latest book on Lake Powell is, you know, a big part of the history of river running in the Southwest, was the loss of Glen Canyon to Lake Powell in the 1960s. There's a lot of, you know, what I often refer to as propaganda around the loss of that canyon, and used often in a good way to talk about the destructive power of dams to alter a landscape, but, you know, to create these amazing places to do reservoir recreation, which is the way most people experience Lake Powell today.
Right, and there is a lot of people that are listening that have spent a lot of time on Lake Powell. Can you set the stage for us about Lake Powell, a little bit about its history and its origin story, and then that context behind your title, Life After Deadpool?
Yeah, Lake Powell was created starting in 1963 when the Glen Canyon Dam closed its gates for the first time. Construction on the Glen Canyon Dam started in the late 1950s and finished in the mid-1960s. And Lake Powell started filling very quickly in 1963, flooding over 100 river miles within a year up the Colorado River. The reservoir didn't fill completely until the early 1980s, and it was, you know, completely full for the early 80s and then a few years in the 90s, but it's been going down since 1999, the reservoir level has. So for people who have, you know, enjoyed Lake Powell as a houseboat or a, you know, fishing destination, they'll be very familiar with the bathtub ring that's on the cliffs of Lake Powell. That's been visible, you know, since 1999 when these water levels started to drop. And by spring of 2023, Lake Powell was just 20% full. So the decline has, you know, taken a couple of decades, but we are pretty much up against the limit of what the design of the Glen Canyon Dam could handle in terms of low water levels. We were just a few months away from losing hydropower generation at the Glen Canyon Dam and running into real delivery issues of being able to release enough water downstream into the Grand Canyon to supply the millions of people who rely on the Colorado River below the dam. So that's what the Deadpool in the title is referring to, is if the level of Lake Powell were to get to the lowest outlets on the Glen Canyon Dam, which are still hundreds of feet above the river level. You get a situation where there's billions and billions of gallons of water that are trapped in Lake Powell, but there's no way to actively release that water downstream. And that's a big issue for environment and for, you know, reservoir recreation on Lake Powell, but also for everybody who draws water from the river downstream from the dam, from Los Angeles to Las Vegas to Phoenix to Tucson and even Tijuana.
Zach, your book had great illustrations of the way the dam was constructed and is working or not working. I particularly like the wine glass illustration that you had. And it makes so much sense when you think about canyon country being very narrow at the bottom where the river runs and then wider up above. My question, though, as I read the book was, why did they build the dam this way where the outlet wasn't at the very bottom at river level?
Yeah, I mean, I think when the dam was being constructed, the assumption was that it would work as intended for many centuries to come. There was never, I mean, there were definitely people saying that the Lake Powell wasn't needed in terms of the storage required to, you know, make full use of the river within the Colorado River system, even before climate change was an issue that was known. 1950s, you know, there were some critics of the dam saying that there was too much storage being built on the Colorado River and that was going to have diminishing returns the more dams that were constructed, the more water would be lost to evaporation, and that would be an issue in the future. But I think for the majority of people who were involved in the construction of the dam, it was just thought that there would be plenty of water to keep Lake Powell, you know, above 20% full, which is when you start to run into serious concerns with the design of the dam. But that hasn't been the case. I mean, the flow of the Colorado River has declined very significantly. About a fifth of the flow of the river has disappeared on average compared to the previous century since 2000. So it's declined by around 20%. And that has meant there's just not enough water to keep the two biggest reservoirs in the country, Lake Mead and Lake Powell, anywhere close to full. And the demand on the river has not gone down, of course, either, as the Southwest continues to grow. So we have less water and same amount of demand we've always had in the Southwest. And that's led to these reservoirs getting to record low levels.
One of the things that I found so compelling about the book, Zach, was the historical context that you give for so much and so many of the different issues, whether that's regarding the indigenous people or the way the dam was built in the first place, including the information that you had about Hoover Dam and the efforts behind that construction and the way you quoted Willie Guthrie in there. And you bring up the idea that the modern environmental movement has largely failed because it hasn't tapped into that same sort of populist sentiment that was prevalent in the country during the New Deal. And now the environmental movement is seen more as an elite endeavor represented by lawyers in suits. How would you suggest rekindling a broader interest with people who don't usually consider themselves environmentalists?
I think part of the brilliance of the New Deal, which is something that I wasn't, you know, very familiar with the history of before I started this book project, was that, you know, of course, the U.S. was going through the Great Depression in the 1930s. Millions of people were out of work. But the brilliance of the New Deal was to, you know, do useful projects. You know, the federal projects put millions of people to work building sidewalks and courthouses and trails on public lands, but also, and most dramatically, these giant dams across the West. And that, you know, had real results, not only in the employment it provided to people in the middle of the Great Depression, but also the public power it provided to electrify the rural parts of the U.S. and bring power to farms that never had it, and to small towns, and to do that at, you know, cheaper rates than the private sector was offering. So it was kind of a coalescing of a bunch of economic and political forces to get, you know, America working on a collective project to see some hope on the other side of the Great Depression. And the dams were really powerful symbols, including the Hoover Dam, of what America could accomplish if it worked together. And that's a very different vision than the one we get from the environmental movement in its modern incarnation, which, you know, often doesn't talk as much about you know, massive jobs programs or federal spending on public power projects. But the New Deal, you know, what did see itself as part of, you know, segments of the New Deal saw themselves as part of a conservation project of a little bit different than the one we, you know, often think of today, but of, you know, putting natural resources to work for the people and stopping the worst tendencies of private industry to, you know, clear-cut forests or to overuse water supplies because their, you know, goals are being profit as opposed to the public good. So that was part of the New Deal vision as well, is to use resources more wisely.
Yeah, and let's get into some of the things that are happening with the ecosystem now and what's happening today as a result of this due to the changing climate and these design flaws in the Glen Canyon Dam. Let's talk about some of the environmental impacts, for example, the sediment and some of the consequences that are happening.
Yeah, what's happened in the side canyons, the tributary streams that flow into Glen Canyon since 1999 is what really got me interested in working on this book project. Glen Canyon is very famous for having drowned, you know, national park quality landscape that was drowned in the 1960s by Lake Powell. But it wasn't it's not as well known that a lot of these places that were flooded in the 1960s have started to come back to life as Lake Powell has shrunk to lower and lower levels. And the ecological recovery that's already occurring in Glen Canyon has, you know, blown away even experts in the field of ecology who have studied, you know, how these ecosystems are springing back to life, how beavers have moved back into the side canyons, damming streams, how there's 80-foot tall cottonwood trees that are growing up beneath the bathtub ring, beneath the full pool mark and Lake Powell. And these, despite, you know, starting completely from scratch in the early 2000s, they're ecosystems that are incredibly biodiverse and healthy at this point. So it's an interesting, you know, part of the story of Lake Powell, which, you know, is either, depending on your perspective, was a tragedy of, you know, a lake flooding Glen Canyon, the creation of this amazing, you know, reservoir recreation paradise. But not a lot of people from either of those camps are very familiar with the recovery that's occurring kind of beyond the margins of the current lake footprint near the high water mark of the lake. And it's a really important part of the puzzle. It's fascinating to go out and explore.
One of the things that I really enjoyed about the book was that it's not just sort of the doom and gloom, oh my goodness, it's drying up and it's going to be a vast mud flat. But the, you know, repeated finding of these areas that really are returning with a lot of, you know, the native plants and animals there, which made reading the book really interesting, actually. And one of the more fascinating ideas that you put forth was reusing some of the area where the return of indigenous species or native species is harder, and using that for solar panels, and then the combination of a new dam that would run when the, you know, generate energy when the solar panels are dark. Can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for taking all these ideas I put forward in the book so seriously and asking that question. So yeah, there's over 100 tributary streams that flow into Glen Canyon across Lake Powell's 180-mile plus length. Most of those are perennial streams that have, you know, flowing water year round, and they've created these really lush habitats where this ecological recovery is occurring that I was just talking about. They're really beautiful slot canyons, or they have waterfalls and pools and arches, and they're just amazing places. But closer to Page, there are these giant, what used to be bays of Lake Powell, Waweep Bay and Site Bay and others, that have now are just, you know, kind of dry flats that don't have streams in them, don't, you know, are miles from the lake now in some places as the lake has receded. And those areas are having a much slower ecological recovery. So what you see there is kind of dead tamarisk trees, which is an invasive species that used to be at the water's edge, but now are very far from the lake and have died out. There's, you know, various lawn chairs and things that have blown off houseboats over the years. And these areas are located right next to the transmission lines from Glen Canyon Dam, but also the even larger transmission lines from the Navajo Generating Station coal-fired power plant that closed in 2019. So one of the ideas in the book is to, you know, in that spirit of the New Deal, of building public power, and using that to fund even more power projects, which is how the dams worked in the 1930s to 60s, would be to build solar panels, you know, big solar farms in these bays that have less ecological value, are already disturbed landscapes from having been under the reservoir for decades and decades, and they're located right next to transmission lines that go to cities that need power, that the transmission lines aren't currently being used to their full capacity. And then the pump hydro idea you mentioned is a way to use reservoir or hydropowers as a kind of battery. So something you could do is build two small reservoirs next to the Colorado River in the former bed of Lake Powell that would solar power to pump water uphill to an upper reservoir during the day. And then when the power is needed, but the sun isn't shining, that water could be released into a lower reservoir in kind of a loop to generate power even when the solar power isn't available directly, if that makes sense. So this is an idea that's being explored more and more. There's pump hydro projects that have been built, but it's something that could be a good fit for re-engineering the Glen Canyon Dam power infrastructure and the landscape affected by Lake Powell to still provide public power, but do it in a less water-intensive and environmentally impactful way.
These ideas seemed really timely because I know that transmission lines is an issue that's really popping up quite a bit in certainly in the world of conservation. Because a lot of times when we have a new power source and they want to site the power transmission lines, you know, they're out looking to figure out where those lines can go. And a lot of times they look at the open spaces, some of which might have been conserved for, you know, actual conservation purposes. And on that note, you also bring up the idea of having the federal government pay rural communities for the open spaces, you know, if they have a monument or a national park or some other public benefit access area in their communities. And I thought that was such an interesting idea. I know that hunting and fishing organizations have put a lot of money into conservation because they realize that they need wildlife habitat for their game species. But we don't see the same kind of commitment from the outdoor recreationalists. What if the purchase of a new kayak, say, included a dollar or two for wild river restoration? And I guess I'm asking, how do we change recreational users' view of the lands that they use as something to be paid for?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there's a lot of different ways you could view, you know, the future of funding recreation and public lands in this country. I think what something that's so great about our public land system as it exists is that fees are pretty low in most of these areas, or in a lot of cases on BLM or Forest Service lands, completely free to, you know, visit or recreate in these areas. And I don't know if that's something that necessarily needs to change. I don't really get into the specifics of that in the book. The conversation I relate has to do with the federal payment system. It's called the Payment in Lieu of Taxes, or PILT funding, that goes to rural communities with a lot of federal land in them, rural counties included. And there's, you know, no property taxes being charged on federal land. So this system has been set up to, you know, fund rural counties like San Juan County in Southeast Utah, where I live. But the payments, you know, aren't, they're significant, but they could be bigger to help support county services. So, you know, the idea that somebody proposes one of my friends, is, you know, rewarding rural communities for having more conserved land in those counties. So if you have more wilderness areas or national monuments or just lands that have a higher level of conservation protection, then that PILT funding would be bigger as a way to reward communities that might lose revenue to extraction or whatever that is. Of course, that's very far from the local climate we're living in now, where regulations are being rolled back from all across the EPA and other federal agencies, and you know, extraction is being opened up more and more. But this would be an alternative to, you know, the demands for more revenue for counties in places like rural Utah.
Well, Zach, we certainly appreciate your time with us today on This Green Earth and talking to us more about your latest title, After Deadpool, Lake Powell's Last Days and the Rebirth of the Colorado River. Zach is an award-winning author and conservationist and will be speaking here in Park City on March 24th at the Jim Santee Auditorium at 6 p.m. And this is brought to the community. It's a free event hosted by the Friends of the Park City Library. So, Zach, tell us a little bit about that talk and what you're hoping to bring to us.
Sure. Well, thanks for all those great questions. That was, you know, more ground than I was covering even in the talk itself. So I'll be showing a slideshow at the library in Park City on Monday, showing photos that showcase some of this ecological rebirth that I've been talking about in the side canyons, explaining the design of the Glen Canyon Dam, explaining issues with the sediment that's accumulated in Lake Powell, and talking about the future of the reservoir. So expect to see a lot of photos and to hear more details about some of what we've discussed in the book.
And if people wanted to learn more about you or your writings, is there a website they can go to?
I've got a website, zachpodmore.com, and you can find the book pretty much anywhere books are sold, but Park City Library or your local bookstore is a great place to start.
Excellent. Well, Zach, thank you so much for joining us today on This Green Earth, and we hope to have you on again in the future to discuss more of what is happening there in the Glen Canyon. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Joining us next is Wes Sidaway, who is a local conservation easement landowner, and he's going to talk to us more about his family's decision around land preservation, and we'll talk to Cheryl overall about the importance of land preservation in our community. Cheryl, do you want to kind of set the stage for Wes?
So the Summit Land Conservancy started working with the Sidaway family probably back around 2010, 2011. Wes's dad, Robert, called us up and said, hey, I think we're interested in putting a conservation easement on about 73 acres that the family owned right along the Weber River just before it flows into Rockport Dam, Rockport Reservoir. On the other side of the river, the land was already being subdivided and developed into lovely waterfront, riverfront properties. So we at the Summit Land Conservancy were super excited that the Sitaway family was interested in preserving their natural heritage. So I'm really excited to welcome Wes Sitaway, who is a lifelong resident of Summit County, to this Green Earth today.
Welcome, Wes.
Thanks, Claire. Cheryl, thanks. Appreciate the opportunity to be on this morning, and always anything I can do for land conservation and to support that, and definitely Cheryl. Can't say enough about Cheryl and the Summit Land organization and what they're doing out there for all of us. So
yeah,
happy to be here.
Yeah, the feeling is mutual about that. Yes. Well, why don't you start by telling us a little bit about your family's history and your land ownership?
Okay. Our land, my grandfather, Keith Sidway, back in the early 30s, started to put the land together. He purchased land from relatives and other people in the area to create what is now our ranch. A lot of that started as homesteads, even as we get back into the history of it, you know, small pieces. And he ran milk cows, and then beef cattle was his primary source of income back then. And then my dad was an only child, so he passed that on to him. And then my dad's just ran the cattle and kept the beef operation. We don't have milk cows anymore, but and now it's me and my family and my sister. She has two boys, and I have a boy and a girl. So we're really on to the fourth generation, I guess, if you will, of Sitaway's run on this. That's kind of the history of our land and where it originated and what we've been doing with it.
And talk to us about the land, actually, where it lays and what the environment looks like there.
Okay, so we run our cattle on the 73 acres that's under conservation easement, and then we have about another 1,000 acres that some of it's contiguous and then some of it's separated. It's right here around Rockport to the east, where we run our cattle in the summer on range ground. And as Cheryl mentioned, we're right at the inlet side of Weber River going into Rockport Reservoir. Some of my grandfather's land was actually under what is now Rockport Reservoir. His original milk barn was under there.
Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what was the conversation in your family, and why did you decide to put that land, that really beautiful pasture land? You know, it's visible from State Road 32 if people are driving between, say, Rockport Reservoir and Browns Canyon. Why did your family decide to do that?
The idea came to my dad from one of his mentors that really helped him in the cattle business. Their family had put a conservation easement on some of their property down by Wanship. And so that was really where the idea started. One landowner passing to another, hey, this is a good idea. Maybe you ought to look into it. And dad started considering it back then, like Cheryl said, back in the, I guess, 08, 09, even 2010 era. We sat down as a family and looked at it and really molded over. Being that the encroachment was coming, as Cheryl mentioned, a lot of luxury homes, people were buying right next to the river. And so the pressure was on my dad a lot to sell, which he had no interest then and still definitely not now. So we considered as a great option to help my dad and mom have a little bit of financial stability as they were getting older, and then really preserve the land and protect it so that it didn't ever have a home on it. My grandpa was awesome enough to pass on this land, and we just really felt like this is what it should be used for, regardless of who owns it in the future. So that was our hope.
Wes, you famously said to me one time that land isn't something that you own, that you steward it. Do you want to talk a little bit about that sentiment?
For sure.
I mean, you do own it.
We do own it, and it's definitely our...
It's your responsibility.
Our task every day to take care of it. And, mm-hmm. you know, there's costs that are associated with it that we're responsible for. But as I think about it, we're really only here for a short time. If you look at the history of just the earth in general. And so I do believe that we are responsible to leave it for the next generation, at least at a bare minimum at the point that we received it. But it should be better, right? I mean, we should take care of it and leave it better for whoever comes beyond us. And so in that sense, I guess, Cheryl, that's where I think we really are just kind of the caretakers here for the short time that we do have it. Yeah, ownership. And ownership, I guess, is always an interesting thing to me is, yeah, we all own it per se, similar to anyone that may own other possessions. But the land itself has its own, how do I say this? I guess it has its own life, a lot of life to it. So I don't think you can truly own land.
It kind of owns you.
It owns you. Yeah, it owns you, and it'll take care of you if you take care of it, and it'll kick your butt if you don't take care of it, neglect it. So.
This is a sentiment that we hear from a lot of the landowners that come to the Summit Land Conservancy who really want to preserve what they've been given, preserve their heritage as a legacy for their next generation. And so I wanted to see if that was your experience as well, Wes. You've been serving on the Summit County's Open Space Advisory Committee for a number of years after your family went ahead and did this. And I think, we're lucky to have conservation landowners like you who are willing to serve on these public committees, volunteer for these public committees, because you bring such an important experience to the table. And I was wondering if you see some unifying factors among farmers and ranchers who decide to pursue conservation.
I do, Cheryl. I would say that's the most common motivation and underlying comments that I receive from landowners who approach me, and they're curious to, you know, the process and what it looks like, what it might be. And everyone will say, gosh, we love the land and we want it to stay in this capacity, or, you know, stay in agriculture, stay in open space. And so that's really, I believe, what motivates all of us over here in Summit County and the other counties surrounding us, is they just, the true desire to see it stay as is, if you will. And really, you know, the interesting part is that I'm around other people who either build homes or develop and all that. And it's unfortunate that most people don't realize that land conservation is a true avenue for land, and it brings as much value as our other highest best use, as it's commonly termed in planning. Cheryl's done a great job. I think our county has benefited, because of the outreach, and our county has taken good steps with the bond to put forth the effort to try and offer up land conservation. The desire is out there from the landowners, for sure.
Yeah, I'm curious about how many landowners maybe yearly that approach, and how many are being approached, and what does that look like in our community?
I'll let Wes speak to that in terms of the county's Open Space Advisory Committee. I don't know how much they can say, because it's since it's a land deal, a lot of that happens behind closed doors. But Summit Land Conservancy has a line of landowners out the door right now, more people who would like to do conservation than we can, we'll tell people, well, we can't put your application in this year, but maybe next year. This is all across the Wasatch Back, which is where the Summit Land Conservancy works. So around Hoytsville, Colville right now, Summit Land Conservancy put in four applications for four different families for federal funding that on land that totaled 16,000 acres. So with the federal funding being frozen for a little while, we don't know if any of those will get funded. These people have owned their land for years, and we take a long view, and things, until the backhoes show up, we don't give up.
Right. And Wes, did you have comments about that being on the advisory committee, about the desire from landowners?
Yeah, the desire has been there. I think we've hit maybe a lull. And if I can just maybe throw a plug out there, if anyone's listening, that, definitely reach out to the team at Summit County and Summit Land to pursue this option of land conservation. I think it comes in waves. The one thing, most landowners, they're a lot of head down, down to work. And so as winter comes in, it's sometimes maybe our slower time. And so they start thinking about progression and maybe transferring. And so it just depends on how many people come in and approach OSAC and Summit Land. As Cheryl mentioned, it's gained a lot of traction in the last year or two. There's only so much land. I just always want to say, right? There's only so much land. It's a limited resource.
Was your family, when the Conservancy did your easement, your family's easement in 2013, We used federal funding from the Farm Bill, which is one of our main funding sources. Was your family concerned about that, about, you know, having federal funding involved with your property?
For sure. Yeah, initial look, and I get the question a lot from other landowners considering this option, is, was the government going to own my land? Is the government going to have a say in my land? Most landowners, they feel pride in it, right? And they put their blood, sweat, and tears in the land every day. And so the thought of an outside government agency definitely brings up fear. But what I'm proud to say, and glad that I can offer that advice and guidance, is it's been great. We developed a plan with the NRCS, and we execute the plan, and they offer assistance to help us execute that plan. But no one's came in and dictated or told us what to do with our land. It's still very much ours, and we ran it as we did before the easement. Yeah, initially, Cheryl, there's always that, oh my gosh, what would this look like? But if I can just leave people with that peace of mind today, it's not an ownership. You're not giving up ownership. It's more of a partnership. We had that concern with the fishing access. Our property has some fishing access with the DWR. Initially, that was a huge holdup, but I have to say today, almost 15 years later, it's been great. No problems whatsoever with that.
That's right. I remember a conversation with family about whether or not they were going to be willing to have that access for DWR, and because there was funding associated with it. So that was an interesting conversation. I'm grateful that your family worked through that with us.
Yeah, and I think about, as we talk about preservation and just in that word preserve, what are your hopes then, Wes, for future generations? And why do you think it's important to act now in these conservation and preservation efforts for our future generations?
I work in the construction industry. Once it's paved, it's really difficult and not cost-effective to get it back to its natural state right now. And so a lot of people have a short-term view, I feel, with land. Land conservation is, as Cheryl mentioned, really the long view. We're so grateful that, you know, years and years ago, a lot of land was put into national parks and forests, things like that. But as I mentioned, there's only so much land, and a lot of it's private now. And so I guess we need those landowners to step up and look at a different option instead of just development. I mean, I know Cheryl and I would like to see, you know, very limited development, but it is a part of life. I guess we do have to see some of that still continue, but we only have the opportunity now to preserve the land. I look at any city I've ever traveled to, they all look the same to me.
Well, I grew up in Orange County, California, which was a beautiful area of orange groves and avocado groves and strawberry fields. And it doesn't look like that anymore, which is one of the reasons that I do what I do here at the Summit Land Conservancy. And I think I do need to say, because of the rules around broadcasting, that the Summit Land Conservancy is a supporter of KPCW. We like to come on during the pledge drives and talk about our work and our partners, and I get to come on the news hour pretty frequently and talk about the work we do. And so Summit Land Conservancy is really grateful that we have KPCW as a nonprofit in our community, because it helps our organization and so many others get the word out about what we do. And then, of course, there's also these terrific morning news shows where we get to talk to interesting people like Wes Sidaway, who's one of our conservation easement landowners.
Absolutely. And over the years, Cheryl, you said earlier, which I am heartened by, that there are many people coming to you and asking questions and wanting to know more. And I would think in this particular, I'm going to use the word climate in both ways here, that we're pushed up against now maybe more than ever. It is important for people to step up and make these decisions around what it looks like for the land in the future.
Wes, I'd like to ask you this question. And I think it was something that we were talking about a few minutes ago, is the Summit Land Conservancy and the work that we do, you know, it really is about land rights, ownership rights. People, everyone knows they have the right to develop. They also have the right not to. But I think sometimes the work we do is thought of as, you know, I don't know, environmentalist conservation, that type of thing. How do we bring together Wes, people who maybe don't think of themselves as environmentalists?
And I don't want to speak for all landowners and ranchers. I know myself, I don't consider myself an environmentalist either, just more of a steward of the land. And I will say that it's been a great experience to be part of Summit Land and part of the organization. It's helped me realize different views of people and what matters to really all of us. The open space, it's hard to understand until you enjoy it. I think that's why everyone's moving to our great county, is because they love it here. It's not Orange County. And I think continued communication and education that land conservation is great for the environment, but it doesn't mean that you're an environmentalist, I guess. I think we all need to take care of our environment. And it doesn't, hopefully we're still in that mode that we can all agree on that common ground. We all live here and it needs to be taken care of.
I appreciate your point of view on that, because on our show, we do talk about the environment and we do talk about conservation and we lean in that direction. And there are so many ways of engaging in conversation and finding that common ground and that understanding, and those different perspectives, I think, lead us on the right path. So I appreciate that answer.
That's one of the really wonderful things about the work that I get to do at Summit Land Conservancy, is we get to bring together people who maybe aren't talking to each other these days, and realizing that we actually do have an awful lot in common. I remember sitting at a meeting in Eastern Summit County at some point, and everybody was in that room for the same reason. It was because we all love the rural beauty of Summit County. And I think it's super important to realize that rural beauty is, you know, it doesn't happen by accident. It doesn't happen for free. It happens because of families like Wes's who have been willing to really make a major commitment to preserve their heritage and their beauty of the community, beauty of the landscape. Wes, what's the best thing about having placed your land in a conservation easement?
It's the best thing. The best thing for me is when I drive down the road, I look out past the field and know, yeah, that's what that'll look like tomorrow. And that's what that'll look like long after I'm gone. Because it is forever. It's the closest thing. Cheryl always was great about, hey, you know, this is forever. You know, this is probably one of the only things that truly in land can be forever. And taking my kids out to their calves and know that that's there for them. And it'll be there for future generations.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's great. Wes, we so appreciate your just candidness about land ownership and conservation and your willingness to keep these places preserved. And I can picture you with your kids out there and what that must mean to you as a dad, knowing generation to generation, that's going to stay there for them. So thank you so much for giving us a viewpoint from a landowner for a conservation easement. Wes Sidway, thank you for being part of this Green Earth.
Thank you, Wes.
Yeah, thanks, Claire. Thanks, Cheryl.